Welcome everyone to another episode of the Comic Chronicle Podcast. I'm your host Dakota Morgan, coming to you from Phoenix, Arizona. We have a fun guest on today. Kevin Van Hook is on the show. He is the co-creator of Bloodshot, but more importantly, he's done so much work. Well, that's huge in general, but he's done so much work in film, in television, comics. He's done so much work. The guy is a never-ending workhorse of a power. I relate hard to that as a guy who works in film and comics. Very, very motivating episode to people out there, for fellow creatives. Whether you're a writer, an artist, you work in comics, you work in film, television, a lot of motivation here that Kevin gives. And it's a very, very chill episode today, guys. I hope you enjoy it. Hopefully you guys check out Bloodshot 2020, to say the least. If not, go check out the trailer now. Make sure you guys follow Kevin on social media as well, too. And stay tuned for us. Make sure you guys subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or comiccronicle.podbean.com. It helps us out greatly. And make sure you guys share the show. That also helps, too. Thanks everyone for tuning in this episode. Hopefully you guys like it. Stay tuned for more fun guests on the show. And without further ado, our fun talk with Kevin. We're recording.
Excellent.
Kevin, welcome to the show, man.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate you having me on.
Of course. And I gotta say, as a fellow creator, what we were just talking about just before we started recording, you gotta be extremely enjoying life right now, to say the least.
Well, I'm not very excited, especially, you know, with the Bloodshot movie coming out and everything based on my book. And so that's very cool. It's neat to see it happen after all this time.
Yeah, like, as a creator, it's always one of those where I think people don't really understand the fact of, it's always, like, the creators of stuff, whether you write, whether you draw, whatnot, and I think writers especially, is when we actually see something come to life, whether it's just on a page, whether it's, like, live action or something like that, I think people discount the fact of, like, oh, they just write and this is whatever. Like, no, we love seeing creations come to life, you know?
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, it's if there wasn't a story, there'd be nothing to make a movie about.
It's true. It's very, very true. Now, Kevin, we were talking about it before, and I want to dive into it before we talk all about comics and such, which is the nature of the show, but I did want to touch upon, because your movie background a little bit. Let people know, like, what exactly you did.
Well, essentially, I'd worked in comics most of my life until I was in my late 20s, and then I decided to to transition. I wanted to work in movies and television, and started teaching myself visual effects and 3D animation at that time. Mm-hmm. And because I was also a computer geek, you have to forgive me. I've got a bit of a cold I'm fighting.
Oh, you're good.
I was a bit of a computer geek. I had email since 1985. You know, I was taught myself how to program in the early to mid 80s, late 80s. Mm-hmm. And so when computer animation rolled around and became viable, it let me kind of have meet two of my worlds together. And because I was never really a practical models guy, I didn't build plastic cars and spaceships and stuff in my garage as a kid, any of that stuff. But I was fascinated by what I could do with computers, and so I started doing 3D animation and things, and moved my studio, set up a studio rather, in San Diego. I moved my family across country from New York, and started doing teaching myself visual effects, filmmaking. Made my first short. Kind of learned an incredible amount. It was my film school. It dealt with Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. It dealt with had a high fall and a burning gag and sword fights and horse rides and a lot of stuff in it, and really didn't know what the hell I was doing. And learned an incredible amount, and then started just putting my first film together. So it took me 5 years, but I made my first feature, and it ended up being the 18th highest grossing direct-to-DVD release of 2003. Jeez. And based on that success, I was in the right place at the right time and managed to get a series of films greenlit, which I did with Anchor Bay and Sci-Fi Channel as the home television component. Mm-hmm. And managed to do six films back-to-back. And so it was a great ride to do that stuff. And along the way, I built up my visual effects company. And so we did visual effects on iRobot, Miss Congeniality, Daredevil, lots of TV shows, all the Law and Order shows, and I went independent and continued to do that. And so I do that a lot for studio films as well as independent features and TV shows. And so all the while trying to keep my hand in comics every now and then by writing something, usually for DC.
Mm-hmm. So well, you touched upon those.
That's kind of the nutshell version.
Yeah, you know what? That's an incredible damn story, I gotta say, because that proves, Kevin, you're always creating. Like, you're always going, you're always working, and it really shows that you never know where one love, one interest may take you. And I think people need to know that, too, is, you know, you started in comics, you went forward a little bit, then you were a computer nerd and took, which I do appreciate a lot, and you started in a time and you made it work. I mean, when did you start doing visual effects? What year was that?
Well, professionally started them in the end of 97.
Ah, so it was still it was a good time, but you were, what year, I mean, 97 wasn't really the year, or was it the year where visual effects started really taking off? Like, they started really, really getting better, and it was like the beginning of the era. Was it 97?
Well, it depends on which era you're talking about. I mean, the big thing was, you know, 93 was Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
You know, which was, you know, heralded the fact that, okay, this is really, truly possible with creatures. And, you know, and everybody, you know, it's such a wonderful film anyway.
Yes.
But there's only 50 CG shots in the film. And a lot of people think that, you know, assume that there's a whole lot more. But it's a wonderful blend of practical effects and visual effects, digital effects. And by 97, so in 97, buddy of mine who was working with me at the time, we started working on creating elements, and I kind of was always toying around with how do I make something digitally using particles, making smoke and fire and those kind of things. And so we did a lot of elements for a TV show called Conan the Adventurer. Conan the Adventurer, I think was the name of it.
Mm.
But it was the it was a short-lived show. But we did that, and then almost immediately I started storyboarding for Disney, and so I storyboarded the 13th Warrior movie with Antonio Banderas. I storyboarded a lot of pilots, and in a very short amount of time, in 3 to 5 months. And then we got a chance to work on My Favorite Martian, which was a film by Donald Petrie,
mm-hmm.
and had Christopher Lloyd and Jeff Daniels, and that was just a blast, and learned an incredible amount working on a feature film. And then jumped over to some TV stuff. We did Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. And, you know, it was a fascinating difference because, you know, feature, we were used to having a good solid week to kind of get a shot looking pretty good in 3D and maybe another few days to finesse that and make some revisions. And in television, we turned in our first couple of shots the first day just to kind of show where we were roughing in the animation. And they're like, okay, sold, done. We're like, no, we're not finished.
Yeah,
it was just an amazing difference to do that. And then we ended up on Hercules and Xena for the last two seasons of those shows, which was really cool. And we did a bunch of animated shows. We did NASCAR Racers and Max Steel,
mm-hmm.
for completely all CG shows. And so it was an interesting time. But yeah, as far as when, you know, what heralded the new era, it's really hard to say when you would want to consider it. I mean, because, you know, even though we started in 97, Matrix was 99.
Oh, God, that's right.
And, you know, it was still, still somewhat in its infancy then. You know, it's always evolving and things. Titanic is, like, I want to say is 97, 98, 97, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, something around that line.
And it had digital people that didn't really look all that great, but it had digital people. And that was kind of cool, and you bought it when you watched the movie.
It's true. Do you keep working on VFX? Like, is visual effects sort of the thing you're going towards now? Like, because there's a lot of fans who do work in VFX on the film show I do, and then they listen to this show too, who operate out of London. Do you still currently work in visual effects, or is it one of those things?
No, I do. The bulk of my living comes from supervising, producing, and creating visual effects.
Mm.
I just finished a Liam Neeson movie called Honest Thief and an Aaron Eckhart movie called Live this summer. Mm. And last December, I supervised on a Netflix original called Power, starring Jamie Foxx and Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Heard of that, man. So you've had your hands in everything. Like, there's not everything, but there's a good majority of stuff you've had your hands in. So, because you're just name dropping stuff so much, it's like a birthday cake.
No, yeah, definitely did a lot of stuff, and because I had a print background, which kind of goes hand in hand with the original Bloodshot books and things like that, because that was using specialized printing techniques. We were the first Chromium comic book cover. I did a lot in design. So my studio initially was a design studio. So we did trading cards, toy packaging, temporary stickers, tattoos, all that kind of stuff. So we did all kinds of licensed properties, Sailor Moon and the very first Pokemon stuff that hit, and all kinds of work in that era. And so for a while, my studio was really kind of divided into two. It was print versus visual effects and animation.
Jesus. Well, let's go back a little bit. I always like asking people this thing, this kind of question is, let's go back to younger Kevin. What was that thing, man, that really got you to decide, I want to be a creative, and that was that moment or that thing that you read or saw and be like, before VFX, before movies, before comics, that changed you, that made you want to go into do what you do today?
I think I had always drawn a little bit, but at 8 years old, my brother got me a Flintstones, How to Draw Flintstones animation kit for Christmas, which was like a little bitty light box and some pre-drawn characters and backgrounds, and then you're supposed to basically, you know, trace onto the clean paper. And doing that, I learned from that, and I enjoyed that a lot, and I decided I want to make comics. And then that same brother, my brother Bill, had a friend named Mark Tevis, and Mark lent him a big, huge stack of Fantastic Four comics, about a year's worth of books. And when I was maybe 10 or 11 years old, and I read through them all. And it was interesting because my brother was into the same kinds of things. A lot of the things that influenced me came from him. But for him, they were a passing interest and nothing more. And for me, they became my life. So my taste in Hammer horror films, and my taste in comics and monster kid stuff and all that, and science fiction movies and animation and all that, largely was inspired by him. But it's just something that, you know, it just was more of a, as I say, a passing interest or a hobby. But for me, it was something that I wanted to pursue.
I'm imagining its goals. He's like, that? Oh, pff, I don't need that no more. You can take it. Meanwhile, you're like the drug addict. Like, yes, I definitely will. This is amazing.
There was some of that. It wasn't as much physical stuff that was like handed down as much as like I could read those things and enjoy them. It was definitely one of the biggest things that influenced me. And then when I was 12, 13 years old, we moved to Detroit from the country in southern Indiana, and suddenly I was always curious and always pushing, and so I found out where a comic book shop was, and I got somebody to take me, and that was it. So my dad was doing pretty decently work-wise. He was working in the automotive industry at the time, and I had never had an allowance, and so I had a $10 a week allowance, which, you know, in 1977 is a pretty big deal, and so I could go buy, at that time, I could buy 40 comic books.
Jeez.
Or I could buy, actually not 40, I guess it was, I did the math backwards. Oops. There were 40 cents a piece, I could buy 25 comic books.
Still.
which is still a lot.
Oh, God, yeah.
But I figured out how to maximize those dollars, and I could take two city buses and get out to this place, and I could still buy some comics and stop off at McDonald's and have two burgers, fries, and a Coke and be good. So it was a change in my life. And then after a while, I realized I wanted to have some really higher-end collectible stuff, and I actually made a deal with the lady that owned the comic shop to let me put $10 a week. I spent the whole wad on Spider-Man number one.
Ooh.
I bought a Spider-Man number one for $110, and it took me, you know, I put $40 down, and then the rest was a week at a time. But I was very serious about it, and I was doing the bags and boards and the whole thing in an era where that was really just kind of starting to be a thing. And I was still somewhat isolated. I didn't really know other collectors. I just knew my friends who also loved comics. But I drew and constantly, and I was fortunate to go to a high school of the arts for a few months and have multiple art classes a day, which was helpful.
So you've always just been creating. You were inspired by the sci-fi. Which genre? Oh, actually, I kind of want to ask, what genres do you seem you relate to the most, or really go to the most?
As far as creatively, what do I tend to write?
Stuff you're like a fan of, like what do you often say you're watching, or like creatively, like whatever maybe you can get almost, but in the sense where like stuff you really, but like that your brother kind of got you hooked on. What was like the sort of, was it horror, thriller, sci-fi?
Yeah, it was horror and sci-fi. Yeah. I would say they, growing up when I did, we had Saturday afternoon reruns of like the Universal monster movies, so. You could pretty regularly catch The Wolfman or Frankenstein or that kind of stuff pretty easily, and then we also had the local horror hosts. So in Michigan, it was Sir Graves Gasley, in Southern Indiana and Kentucky, it was Sammy Terry. Mm-hmm. So these guys who would bring on the horror movies like Elvira.
Ooh.
And so I'd stay up late at night and catch these things that I'd read about in books but had never seen, like Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde or the Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee Dracula movies from Hammer.
Oh, classics.
So beautifully done, and fell in love with that stuff. But yeah, I still love horror. I still have a soft spot in my heart for horror. When I was about 13, I read I Am Legend and Dracula in the same week, and they had a big impact on me. Mm-hmm. And then 12 years later, I discovered Clive Barker. He was just brand new on the scene, and it was really, really cool. And I had already, by that point, read all of Stephen King's existing stuff. So I was a voracious reader as a young man. But I also love mysteries. I love an author named Lawrence Block, who's a mystery and detective fiction kind of character. And he also wrote a lot about the art of writing. So he used to have a regular column in Writer's Digest.
I gotta ask, Kevin, where do you find the time in your life to do all of this?
I think I historically didn't sleep a lot.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Also, I mean, it's just what I enjoy. And I don't tend to watch a whole lot of TV anymore. I watch certain things that I'm excited about. I did follow Game of Thrones. I watched my friend Mark Verheiden's Swamp Thing series this last year. I'll make a point of trying to catch those kinds of things and event things. And I love the Marvel movies. There's no bigger thrill than seeing the last act of Endgame, and that moment when Thor's hammer lifts up off the ground and lands in Cap's hand—that's pretty cool. So I love all that kind of stuff. I do still enjoy the Star Wars movies, and I Star Wars was one of those things. I had a neighbor downstairs when I was a kid that was. They were a bit well off, and he had every Star Wars thing imaginable.
Jeez.
And kind of rubbed it in everybody's faces. And they had an early VCR. It was the size of a small Buick. And so he kind of ruined Star Wars for me a little bit, so I didn't see it the first year. And then when I did see it, I was like, okay, it's really, really cool. I really enjoyed it. And I actually saw it in a Spanish-speaking theater in Detroit. So I saw Spanish subtitles, but I really was taken with that. And then, because of my interest in visual effects and special effects, I followed ILM's track record and their trajectory of doing everything. I've always loved matte paintings and today, even though I mentioned that I've done a lot of 3D stuff, I'm primarily a compositor. When I'm supervising and producing, I'm a senior compositor. So it's more about taking everything and putting it together and trying to make it as believable as possible, if that's what the goal is, than necessarily generating elements. Although I do a lot of digital matte painting type stuff. There was a TV series called Rizzoli and Isles where I did a lot of matte paintings to make it look like it was shot in Boston when we actually were shooting on the back of the Paramount lot.
Jesus. You, sir, are the hardest working man I think I've ever had on the show.
Well, I appreciate it. And what's funny is when I hear things like that, I'm always thinking, like, if you only knew how often I'm just blowing off everything and not doing what I should be doing.
Yeah.
But I appreciate it. I do try, and I want to have a body of work, and I do, and I'm very proud of it. I've written somewhere around between 175 and 200 comic books. And I wrote the Flash Gordon Sunday comic strip, and done a lot of stuff in movies and TV. So it's definitely something I enjoy all of that. I enjoy telling stories.
Hey folks, Dakota here with a little bit of an ad break for you guys today. Do you guys like reading comics? Obviously, if you listen to the show, you do. What the fuck am I talking about? Then you guys, if you're in Arizona, which a good majority of the fan base is, shout out to the ones in Canada though, you guys can go to Drawn to Comics in Glendale, Arizona, located at 5801 West Glendale Avenue in Glendale, Arizona. I gotta say, folks, I've been going here for a long time now. I've been to a few different comic book stores in Arizona in my 6 years of living here so far, and this may change due to the recording nature, but whatever. So I love going to Drawn to Comics. I really do. Ken, who runs it, is amazing, fucking laid-back dude. He's a wonderful guy. He's been on the show, ladies and gentlemen, before, and it's a really fun place to pick up the books. So Drawn to Comics in Glendale, Arizona, get yourself a box, you know? Go in, maybe just check it out. It's a fun place to escape into. His work, all the workers there are fucking wonderful folks. They really are. It's just like family at this point, at least for me. And it's a fun world to go into. There's collectibles there. There's toys. There's comics. You know, and you just get your box and reserve some books and whatnot. We've had people on the show who've written and drawn comics, you know. Go in and pick up their work, folks. Jesus Christ. It ain't that difficult. So go to Drawn the Comics in Glendale, Arizona, folks. You guys can check them out also on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thanks, everyone. Now back to the show. It's true, and I think as creators, that's what we're always doing is people always say to us, like, you guys are always working, because I have those nights where you only get a couple hours of sleep and get up the next 2 hours later, and it's like, okay, well, you got to go back at it again. Like, we just love what we do so much that it's not an addiction, but it's just one of those things where we found what we love, we want to do it all the time, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I'm not afraid to say it's a bit of an addiction. I've been accused of being a workaholic, but it creating gives me a feeling that a lot of other things don't. I did find, just as an aside, when I was young, that until I was in my early 20s, I had the physical need, the compulsion to draw. And then I started learning how to program, and that kind of filled that need, so I didn't have to draw, which meant I missed a few deadlines because I didn't have to anymore. And then I found a few years later that when I started learning how to play guitar, that filled the same kind of creative need. And so it was interesting to me because it literally was a physical compulsion. If I didn't draw, I didn't feel well, I didn't feel whole. I also, as a young man, I got married very young. If my wife and I, were arguing about something, whatever, in our lives, it made it impossible for me to draw.
Yeah.
So that's a vicious cycle. So you can't draw, so you can't make money. So now you're going to argue about not having any money. And it's but that's just the nature of it. And so what you have to do is develop disciplines to where you can do stuff. With writing, I never had the exact same problem. I can write pretty much on demand, and did. So when I was writing Bloodshot, I was also writing Eternal Warrior and Solar Man of the Atom regularly, and was the executive editor of the company. And I would find, I've got 20 minutes before I board my plane to go to a convention. I could probably dialogue a couple pages. So I would do that. And I would, write on the train, going to work, and I would, pretty much write whenever I could do it. At that time, I also split my schedule, so it helped with my sleep patterns a little bit, so I would be there with my wife and kids for dinner. And,
that's
and
important.
Until she put them to bed. Mm-hmm. And they were little boys and twins. And mm-hmm. then I would go to bed for about 5 hours and wake up at like 2 a.m. and write for 2 or 3 hours and then go back to bed. And that worked really well for me at that time. I don't know how well I'd do it today, but at that time I was very productive that way. But it does take its toll. And I had a friend once point out that he felt that I was doing so much output, so concentrated for several years, that he felt I needed to have more input. He felt I needed to see more movies, read more books, and so forth. That was just his opinion. But it was an interesting observation that it can't always go one way. You do need to kind of feed the machine to some degree.
Oh, exactly, because you never know what show, movie, or person or something you hear can inspire you to motivate. Like, maybe you get an idea from, you're like, oh, that sounds pretty cool, and then it just clicks something in your brain where you're like, oh shit, I can put this in a story, or I can put this as an art piece or something. Like, oh, here's a cool idea how to create something.
Sure.
It's like it's a recycling sort of thing, especially for us creators, is you read, you watch something or hear something, you put it into you, and then you put out something, and then that inspires someone else. And it's this whole recycle thing, I like to call it, is being a creator, we take some.
Yeah, no, it's definitely true. And we have to be careful somewhat with that you don't want to get real excited and start creating something and realize, oh, you just ripped off a story you read 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But you do need to have fodder to build off of. And I have discussions with artists and writers about how much work goes into this stuff. Mm-hmm. And had an artist that was wanting to make the point that he felt artists did 10 times the work that a writer does. And my point is, I've done both. I've done both professionally. I've been an editor, an executive editor, an art director, a production manager. Mm-hmm. I've colored, I've lettered, I've done every aspect of comics you can.
You've done it all.
And literally, I've shot plates at a printing press. I've supervised the printing. So I have some authority to say this. I personally feel, yes, obviously an artist is going to spend more time on a given page directly interacting with that paper or that tablet. Hmm. But at the same time, a writer often is, say, it's the old question, how long did it take you to write this? Well, guy says maybe he wrote the novel in a month, but then he starts to think about it. It's like, well, actually, he'd kind of spent the last 2 or 3 months kicking it around and developing characters in his head because he was on a camping trip and he was thinking about how he might tie these things together. He read that one article 4 years ago about how this guy in Korea had gotten wounded in the head and couldn't sleep and yet was still functioning, and how did he fill his time? And you keep going back and you realize at the end of the day, the answer is somewhere around 10 years. Because you're carrying all this stuff for a long time. Hmm. When we write, we typically are not sitting down and just spewing out, hopefully, not just spewing out words on a word processor or an application or a tablet or a notepad or whatever. We're bringing to it everything that we are up to that moment. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of an unfair thing. One of the books that I'm developing now, a young artist named Alex Sarabia, is called The Fifth Horseman, and I want to do it as a comic. I also want to do it as a TV series. But it's an idea that I had when I was 17. So that's, I'm 54.
Wow.
So that's a long time to be carrying around a concept. But it basically was my first short film. It was something I kicked around as doing a movie with Sci-Fi Channel and Anchor Bay Home Video 10 or 12 years ago. But it's just never come to pass. And now it's evolved. It's a different thing now. But it has its roots in something, that is like 37 years old.
So what you're telling me is that when it officially does come out, it will be your best work you've ever done.
Well, I like to think that everything I do is better than the last thing I do. I do tend to believe we're judged that way. Yeah. You're not necessarily judged by your most popular thing. You're judged by the last thing you did.
Yeah.
But it's always hard to say. I mean, it's when I was actively writing comics all the time, one of the things I co-created and wrote was a book called The Visitor at Valiant Comics. And I still feel it's one of the best things I ever wrote. But it was never a huge success. It sold well. It was, you know, I've signed a lot of them. There were definitely fans. Mm-hmm. It was not Bloodshot. And it was fascinating, too, that you know, Solar Man of the Atom was a title I wrote somewhere around 25, 30 issues of. It was very popular, but again, wasn't Bloodshot. And it's interesting because some people will say, well, Bloodshot was a, you know, started off with this really unique cover, and Barry Windsor Smith drew it. It was chromium, it was shiny, it was neat. Mm-hmm. The book was violent, whatever. And they point to, well, that's why it succeeded. But we always maintained, it always stayed at or near the top of our best-selling titles. Mm-hmm. And we, for a long time, first issue sold nearly a million copies. For a long time, we were still averaging 300,000 or 400,000 copies a month, and which was huge. Mm-hmm. By today's standards, this sounds like a fairy tale. But but you can't point to, oh, it's because you started at a million, because 6 months later or so, we did Turok, Dinosaur Hunter, number one, did 1.7 million, and a year later, it was selling, you know, 100,000 copies, 75,000 copies. Mm-hmm. It just didn't have the longevity that didn't have the legs that Bloodshot had. So it's always interesting to see what. So the point of my story being, I put just as much work in an issue of Solar as I did as an issue of Bloodshot or Eternal Warrior. I will say probably Bloodshot was closer because I really defined who that character was. That it was more me, whereas Solar, I was trying to carry on in the footsteps of people who had written it before me. There really is kind of an undefinable reason why it was so successful.
It's true, and it's also a good point to show is you never know what you do. Like, you love everything you do, but you never know what's going to really affect people more. You never know what's going to be that big thing, like, there's a couple of books I've been doing. We've been putting the stuff out digitally, and I never thought my Giant Monster series would kick off. All right, it's going to appeal to fans, but even non-Giant Monster fans are loving it. It's like, okay, I did not I expected maybe the other thing to go for, and it's like, no, people love this more. Like, okay, that's fine. You just never know what you put out there is going to be accepted as something really cool, and you're like, well, I was okay on that. I loved what I did with it, but maybe it could have been better, change one or two things. Fans are like, no, it's perfect. So you never know what fans are going to love, what they're going to hate, or not like as much, to say the least.
Yeah, no, it's always a different thing. I mean, I did, when I first started out, I was doing, I did a black and white series called Jack Frost, and it was just, like a lot of things I do, I just kind of said, okay, I'm just going to start this. And then I'll figure out how to get it distributed and published and whatever later, because I think that's my best plan. At that time, Marvel and DC wasn't knocking down my door. I was talking to a lot of the independent comic book publishers about doing books, but nothing was really clicking. I had done a little bit of work for Pacific Comics, and then they folded. Mm. And so I started writing and drawing a book, and then I went to Chicago Comic Con in 1986, and I had three offers from publishers when I left that weekend to publish the series. Mm-hmm. And I went with one of them, and before the weekend was out, that guy called me up and said, hey, if you can get me a cover based on this other idea over here, I can pay you, get you some money, and give you another book to do, mm-hmm. if you can. And so this was 1986, so the idea of mashup ideas was really popular. So if ninjas are really popular and giant robots are really popular, what do you think about giant ninja robots? And so I did a book called Ninja Bots.
Awesome.
And it was a huge success. It in black and white, it sold 35,000 copies, which, you know, again, by today's standards, that would be like a really good, mainline hero from Marvel or DC.
Oh yeah, that's your Superman, that's your Batman, that's your Spider-Man. That's like,
and it's just kind of an amazing thing. But we had our black and white crash too, so that lasted a few months before things went from selling 35,000 or 40,000 copies to, 10,000 or 8,000, which again, at that time, we felt were devastating, and again, today is not that uncommon. But it was an interesting time to create, and I guess the point of why I bring up Jack Frost is because, again, that was pure me in the sense of what the character was, what he was about. Came from me, and then I worked very closely with a friend of mine who was lettering it and was kind of acting as a springboard on the story. His name Lee Harmon. I was a guy I worked with in graphic design. And he stayed in the business lettering a few books here and there, but was always more of a admirer of the industry and a fan of the industry and a big supporter of mine than somebody who really wanted to make that his career. But it was neat being able to create something and get it out there, and to this day, I'll have. A few years ago was the oddest thing. I met Jim Krueger, who's done all this amazing stuff over at DC stuff, and we were at the Egyptian movie theater in Hollywood, and he recognized me from something, and we started chatting, and he said, "Am I wrong, or did you create Jack Frost?" Like, of all things, for somebody to mention, especially someone like yourself, to mention all these years later, I just thought that was funny, because it's usually I get, didn't you do Bloodshot, or didn't you do whatever, but it's usually something that's much more high profile than a black and white comic I did when I was 21.
Those always throw you for a loop. I swear to God, there's always... When someone does that, it's amazing and it's heartwarming, but then you're also like, how long have you been a fan of mine?
It was one of those things where he and I are close probably to the same age, and so he was coming up around the same time and reading books, and he loves comics, loves the medium, and so he was very familiar with what was coming out.
I like it. I had a similar experience recently. I was at a bar and I did a show. I do acting when I can too. Like yourself, I do a lot, so I relate hard to doing many jobs in film and then also comics. And I was an actor in a short film for the Nerdoballs Network, the network the show's on. And I play like this schizophrenic kind of guy. Found out about this whole conspiracy thing, whatnot, later gets killed and murdered, but. And I was just enjoying a drink, and some guy came up to me. He was like, hey, you were in that film, right? I've done a few things, World War One stuff, whatnot. I'm like, where did you hear me from? He's like, yeah. What film? I said, like, oh, the short film that was on YouTube. I'm like, what? Mind Control? And he's like, yeah, you were in Mind Control. Let me buy a drink. I'm like, okay, sure. It's like the thing they never, because it was a short film we did. It was kind of a test film for the network, their first thing that we did. And I never would have expected to have someone come up to be like, you are not clean, I loved you, like, for that. And that just, like, it blew me away, and also bought me a beer, but still.
Oh, that's very cool.
Hey, it's that fun moment you just never know what you're going to get recognized for.
And it's nice to be acknowledged.
Yes, there was even more, or a little bit recently, I think. You ever went to go to a restaurant or have anything like that, and someone knows who you are?
Usually I get confused with somebody else, but what I did was I was actually on a subway, and I was writing pages of Eternal Warrior, And so I had large, you know, full-size 11 by 17 photocopies in my lap, pencils, and then a yellow legal pad, and I'm dialoguing these pages and then doing balloon indications. And this guy came over and literally was like leaning down looking, and he said, "That's the Eternal Warrior. That means you're Kevin Van Hook, right?"
Oh.
Like, yeah. And it was a little odd, but he was a diehard fan. He was a painter. His name was James Brown. And we gave him a shot, and he colored some books for us. He ended up actually up at Valiant working with us.
That's awesome.
So it's just one of those things, again, you never know who you're going to meet that's going to take you seriously and give you a shot either.
Hey, folks at home, this is your host Dakota here with a little bit of an ad break. Do you guys like the Comic Chronicle podcast, and do you like getting in-depth interviews with people of, moreover, not interviews, but conversations with people in the businesses? Well, guess what? If you love film and television, go check out the Film World podcast that I host on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and filmworld.podbean.com, because I get to talk to people all over from the business of film and TV, of actors, creature actors, writers, directors, cinematographers, all these people, VFX artists, hell. They all come onto the show. We give in-depth conversations about what they do. People from Jurassic World, Planet of the Apes, Transformers, Godzilla, numerous times, you know, and voice actors. And we give all these in-depth conversations with you guys from all sorts of ranges of different things on the Film World podcast. So if you guys like the Comic Chronicle podcast, you'll probably like Film World. Thanks everyone for tuning in. Hopefully you guys are enjoying the show. And now back to the conversation at hand. It's true. Yeah, and you never know what it could bring in the future. Like, it could be a future job opportunity. It could be just a fan. I haven't had the experience yet where I've run into fans who hate me and hate my work. So I can count myself lucky on that one, where it's like, yeah, oh, you.
If I have, they've been polite and kept their mouth shut.
Yeah.
But, that's the truth. But I had, on the other side of that coin, I was attending there's a piece of software called Lightwave 3D from NewTek, and NewTek had a trade show job fair thing. But the point of it was that I had asked a question of the speaker didn't give a very good answer, kind of blew me off, and then this other gentleman stood up and said, "No, it's a real question." You know, and what it was had to do with motion tracking. What are you using for motion tracking shots? And at that time, there were no really good solutions. There was a $10,000 piece of software called Buju, and that was about it. And, you know, most of us can't afford that for a piece of software.
No.
And so the guy tried to him and haw his way out of it, but really didn't give a good answer. But the gentleman that had stood up, I noticed, was wearing a Star Trek jacket, a crew jacket. And I went over to him and introduced myself, and it turned out to be David Stipes, who was a visual effects supervisor on Next Generation, had won an Emmy for that, and he was on Deep Space Nine at the time.
Damn.
And we chatted, and we became friends. And when I made the transition to starting to do visual effects work, he was kind enough to take me and my buddy Chad around and introduce us to shops that were doing work, people that were working on Deep Space Nine. We got to go see some of the very last motion control miniatures being shot at ImageG for Deep Space Nine before it was completely digital. And so again, that was just, you know, I took the shot. I went up to the guy, introduced myself. I was nice. I thanked him for supporting my question and trying to get an answer out of the speaker. And we struck up a relationship and became friends. And it's, you just never know. And it's something that I did a lot more when I was younger, and I wish I were a little better at it today, just because so often, if I were to really look at my career, it's those times that I took the shot.
Yeah.
And just said, what do I have to lose by making a phone call? My career at Valiant Comics, the creation of Bloodshot, the fact that Sony is making a movie called Bloodshot, all goes back to the fact that I had been laid off from a job, took 2 weeks to do some penciling samples and send them out and try to get work, and then followed up with Valiant Comics and ended up getting Jim Shooter on the phone and chatting. And while he didn't want to hire me as a penciler, because his tastes were much more traditional and my stuff was a little bit more dynamic than what he liked. He was very much 5-6 panel pages, Jack Kirby layouts. That was his whole thing. And my stuff was I was intentionally looking fairly modern. I was more like Jim Lee. And but I mentioned the fact that I had a production background and strong Macintosh and pre-press background. He put me on with Bob Layton, who was his right-hand guy at the time. And 2 weeks later, my family and I lived in New Jersey and worked in New York at Valiant. And everything goes back to that, and as far as I'm concerned with it. So it's, it's just something to be said for, don't be a pest, but don't be afraid to introduce yourself, say hi, and if there is a door opened where you can stay in contact with somebody, get feedback, whatever, take it.
That's it. I've said that numerous times on the show, is you have to take the initiative. If you don't take the initiative, nothing's going to come to you. I mean, maybe one or two things, but if you really want to do what you love, if you really want to do that career, you got to take that initiative. I wouldn't be a freelance writer, actor, director, all this other stuff, practical effects guy, if you didn't take that initiative. You wouldn't be doing what you're doing, obviously, with what you just said. You wouldn't be here if you didn't take the initiative and go for it and try and, talk to those people. You have to do that.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah, it's a wonderful world we live in, man. And I've said it on my sister's show, Film World Podcast. I brought on VFX folks from everywhere too, I mentioned before. And I definitely want to tell you this too, is you guys are very integral in making a movie, a TV show, a film, whatever it is. You guys are extremely integral to the process. And I personally think you don't get enough credit, as VFX artists don't. I really think they don't. And they get a little bit. I think more deserves to be given. Do you kind of agree with that, or no? Do you think there's a fair share?
I think that's pretty accurate. I think a lot of people, because really with what I tend to specialize in, which are invisible effects, if I do my job right, you don't know I was there.
Oh, that's true.
So most people assume that movies like, did a movie called SWAT Under Siege. Most people would assume that all the gunplay had real blanks, and that the glass shattering in the windows was all practical and all that. None of that existed. It was all added in post. One of the movies I just did, I burnt two. Actually, both movies I just did this summer ended up burning down a house, all in post. And it's and it's always better if you can have some practical to play off of, to build off of, because one, it gives me as an artist the visual clues I need to see, what does the interactive light look like coming off of a flame against this kind of building and this, this kind of daylight, whatever. But it also, mixing in something real in there helps the eye to just kind of swallow the other stuff.
Yeah.
Although that's funny, not to get off on too much of a tangent, but many times in my career, I've had directors or producers say, "I love everything except this one little thing that's going on over here," and I'm like, "Yeah, that's the real thing you shot."
Oh God. Oh.
But it's on an almost yearly basis, something. Probably once a year, I get that.
Well, you're being honest, and I love that about you, is you're 100% honest, because, it's like, you could be like, oh, well, I can maybe, and you touch it up on your own, and you're like, no, that was you. It's like, I've done my job here. Hold on.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, I'm not going to do him any favors lying to him.
No.
And it's, we have had situations, however, where, like, there was a movie I worked on where the director had extra time. It was a Christmas break. Nobody else was working except me and a couple of guys, and let's play with this one shot, put some extra, hours into it. It's okay, we've got the budget. It's like, all right, fine. I don't mind the overtime. And ended up doing, a lot of iterations of this one tiny shot. It's an important shot, but it's a very brief shot. And it's in a movie called I Am Number 4.
Ooh, I know that one.
And in that film, there's a point where the girl is riding a creature, and she gets flipped up in the air, and then she kind of turns into energy and streaks back to the ground, and she flips through the air. And the whole thing was how to animate her out of there. So ILM had done the creature, I was doing the composite and handling her. And because we're manipulating time, it was all about, let's try getting her out of, you know, clearing her from frame 2 frames earlier, 3 frames later. It was that kind of minutia. Mm-hmm. You know, can we get a little bit more of an arc here? You know, can you warp her back a little bit? You know, these kind of things that aren't, they aren't about real performance that the real character was able to do. It's things we're adding in post. And we're towards the end of the money and end of the time that anybody wanted to work on this thing. I'd been on the shop for 2 weeks. And I, I'd literally come in and it's like, hey, could you revisit this? This is the latest notes. And then, you know, do it. And then 3 or 4 hours later, get another round of notes and go through multiple iterations a day. Mm-hmm. And I get a note and I'm like, I know this sounds weird, but I went to the guy that owned the shop because I was working as a freelancer for him. And I said, this, what he's describing is like version 19. I'm pretty sure. And he said, you think so? And I pulled it up and he said, yeah, damn, that's exactly what he's asking for. And he said, relabel it 69 and send it over. And we did. And he bought it and he loved it and we were done.
Damn.
So it's a little bit of, you know, put a different label on the bottle of wine that they sent back, but it was literally, we wouldn't have done it if it wasn't meeting exactly what the creator was asking for. And it did, so it's like, okay, here you go. And it's just one of those things that, you know, people, one of the worst things you can ever hear is, as an artist, is I'll know it when I see it. And as a creator, I hear that and I go, it's like, well, then you have no vision. I mean, it's I don't have a whole lot of respect for I'll know it when I see it.
Yeah.
But it does come up every now and then. And I really try to push people to give me examples. You know, it's like, what is it you, is there another movie that did something like this you like, another TV show, a theme park ride? Is there something you can give me to work from? So that I can at least get in the ballpark, and then we can start to refine it. But it's an interesting industry. I still love it. I still enjoy it. I tend to prefer TV. I prefer movies because it feels bigger and more prestigious, and there's more time to work on things.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer TV because there's a finite deadline. This thing will air next Saturday. We have to be done by then. And I know I won't be trapped working on this for the next 2 months.
That's it, and you know, you get to see it sooner rather than later, and
oh, absolutely, yeah. Now that was always the one of the biggest kicks working on all of them, really. But Hercules and Xena, I think, because it was the first one of the first series, I guess. Those two series were some of the first I worked on where I actually watched the show anyway.
Oh,
and so nice. It was cool to see, our work come up so quickly.
Yeah.
Because literally, sometimes, you know, we're like finishing on, back then, it would be finishing like on Friday and it aired on Tuesday or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And, but it was that kind of a, you know, 3 days maybe. I have worked tighter. And when my friends at Encore Hollywood were working on an X-Files episode years ago, whether it's an urban legend or not, I don't know, but there was an X-Files episode with bees where Chris Carter wanted more bees in the L.A., the West Coast feed version. Mm-hmm. So there's actually more bees that were rendered and comped in and cut into the show in that 3 hour period. I used to think that might be just a story people told, but I've had several people tell me the same thing, so I think it might be true. But it's just it's how people can be. It's like, I'm gonna mess with this until I can't.
It's true.
And then, of course, and then along comes George Lucas and the idea of DVD and things. I'm going to mess with it forever.
There's a whole bucket of worms on that one, man.
Yeah.
I have a question to ask you, and with your work in film, I hope they didn't miss this opportunity. Did you get a chance to work on the Bloodshot movie at all?
I didn't work on it. No, I didn't. I threw my hat in the ring to say I'd love to do something. I offered to do certain. There were certain effects that, because of the way they shot it, that I knew they would have to do in post.
Yeah, right.
And there were things that I wanted to see in the film specifically that I even said I would do a certain number of these things for free just to make sure you do them.
Mm-hmm.
Which I can't really go into what they were, but of course, were things that I wanted to see done with the character. And It just didn't come to pass.
Missed opportunity.
However, I do have a good relationship with producers and met and spent some time with the director. And I was asked for input at multiple stages along the way.
Okay.
And so so I did give some feedback for the trailer, and I gave some feedback for the film itself in general.
Mm-hmm.
And they've always been very good about including me. I got to spend almost a week in Cape Town, South Africa on set my co-creator, Bob Layton. And so the producer, Dinesh Shamdasani, flew us over and put us up, and we were able to spend time on set. And we hung out with Vin Diesel and Asa Gonzalez and Sam Hugan. It was a great experience. And then I also just want to make a point of saying a lot of times in these things, it's easy to be out of sight and out of mind. I should mention that one of my other co-creators on this, who isn't as vocal, just turned 90.
Is
a man named Don Perlin, who drew the initial run on Bloodshot with me writing it, and as a co-creator. And without Don, we also wouldn't have a Bloodshot.
Yeah, so shout out to you, Don. Yeah, it's always good to give credit, and it's amazing they came to you guys and they knew. And like, you know, it is one of those things where if you don't go to the creators of something and you're trying to make something with it, it's almost like a curse. Because I've heard of productions, and we'll name some, and where they never went to the creators or something for it, based off a book or a different franchise or something, and they made it anyway, and it turned out to be dog shit. Because they didn't go back to the source. They're like, well, we watched the old stuff, read the old stuff. It's like, no, it doesn't count. You got to talk to the people who are involved, if they're alive, hopefully. Because they'll give you the better
input. Well, it's always a challenge is, you know, I mean, people have the feeling that they need to update or reboot or revamp or retcon or what have you. I'm watching reaction videos for Bloodshot trailer, and it's just like anything else. If you put out your best work and people don't like it, there's not an opportunity for you going around to every one of those people and explain what you really meant to do.
Yeah.
And with the Bloodshot trailer, I'm seeing a lot of people making comparisons. Oh, it's like Memento, meets this book or this movie or this comic book character. It's like Deadpool. And I don't have that opportunity to say, while I'm friends with Rob Liefeld and Fabian Nicieza, I've never read a Deadpool comic. I've seen the movies. I love the movies. But I never read the book, and I definitely didn't read them back when I created Bloodshot. So a lot of the ideas a lot of the movie references they're making are movies that have come out in the last 10 years, not realizing, yeah, but the concepts were in our book 27 years ago. Mm. So it's kind of the same problem that Jason Carter experienced, and hopefully we won't experience that anywhere on the level they did, where all these really wonderful and imaginative ideas felt old because Star Wars had mined them, and comic books had mined them, and comic book movies had mined them for years and years and years, where, you know, most people don't realize that a lot of the places where these creatures originated are in a series of novels that were written in the early 1900s.
Yeah. It's true. It's 100% true. I gotta ask you this, though, man. We're coming to the end of the show here, but are you going to get your Bloodshot figure when it comes out by McFarlane?
Oh, absolutely.
Good.
Yeah, it's one, I'm going to make them give me one for sure.
Oh, God, yeah.
And then I might buy a few more. But, I have my 12-inch Bloodshot, maquette statuette figure, which is very cool.
Yeah.
And I definitely want the McFarlane toy. And I even have a Build-A-Bear Workshop Bloodshot teddy bear.
Get the hell out, really?
Yeah, it was a New York Comic Con giveaway exclusive thing a couple years ago.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's cool, and I should go through my boxes in the garage, because I have maybe four Bloodshot figures that fans made for me 27 years ago. So it's where they would take a G.I. Joe or Star Wars figure or whatever and do a complete mod and paint. Those still mean the world to me, too.
That's awesome.
So it's just kind of a neat it's obviously a neat thing to see the mass marketed, you know, produced one based on the movie. But it's also really cool to see something somebody made just because they loved it.
Oh, yeah.
And wanted to give it to me.
That's it. The fanfare is always fun when you get to see that. Like, kind of going back to the fans, is, you know, whenever they do something like that, it always is more amazing than saying, oh, I love your work. It's like, well, here's something I made. I took hours. Oh, yeah. I made it for you. Like, mind blown.
I did a convention back in Orland Park in April, and a young lady brought over I'm going to say knitted. I don't think it's crocheted. I'm pretty sure it's knitted. Mm-hmm. But a little Bloodshot plushy figure.
Oh.
And it's just cute as hell. And it's just a neat thing that you know, she made with love. And it was just really cool to have. I took it with me to New York for luck when I went to the New York City Comic Con.
I love it. I mean, that's awesome. That's adorable. Like, there's stuff I hear. Like, Kiff VH is a voice actor, and he always gets stuff from Bioshock, and he always says he got, like, a scarf or something like that at one point, and he's like, oh, yeah, I carry that thing around. It's like, I've gotten some fan artwork at one or two points of some stuff I did. Like, the only thing I've ever gotten that really, there was a couple things, but the one that sticks out the most to me is I was in a play this year as an actor for a few months, and someone did artwork of my character in a comic strip.
Uh-huh.
I'm not even going to lie to you. My heart sank. And I smiled like the damn Joker for like a whole day. I was like, this is amazing. Like, someone got it. And it was a whole roasting thing of roasting my character. And they're like, oh, your character's getting shit out on. I'm like, I don't care. That is amazing still.
Yeah, no, that's a very cool thing.
Oh, it's one thing where I've made a vow to myself. Well, yeah, kind of a vow, but kind of like I know it's going to happen, is if I ever get a chance to work at a bigger company such as Valiant or DC, Marvel, or Dark Horse, and I get to work on a product that's not my own, I know I'm going to buy collector stuff for it. It's like one of those things. Like,
I think it's cool. I mean, I was lucky to write a bunch of Batman related stuff a few years back, and I don't tend to be somebody that wears, like, just generically wears a Batman t-shirt or something like that, but I do feel, I think it's just partially because I am a creator, so I kind of feel like somebody's going to ask.
Yeah.
Even though they never have. But that, having written Batman and Superman and stuff, at that point I felt, okay, now I've got a license to wear all the cool Batman t-shirts I want and do.
It's true. I thought you were going to say that you were like, and that's why I have a giant 2-foot-tall Batman statue in my office.
No, I never ended up going down the statue route. I liked them, and I even, you know, 20 years ago, every visual effects guy in L.A., We almost all the shops had these same style desks from IKEA, and they were called jerkers, and they were just designed for computers. They were perfect, and you could put monitor on a little hutch stand or two monitors.
Mm-hmm.
Had little wings you could put a telephone on or whatever. But that's not what people did. They put Todd McFarlane action figures all over these things, and so you'd go into any shop practically, and it was as if you could lift that guy's desk and move it into any other shop because it was exactly the same, and it was, you know, all his, you know, all those McFarlane toys. And even then, during that height, I just never really got into it, although a lot of my friends did. I appreciated them. I liked them. But it just wasn't my thing.
And you say McFarlane toys on the workshop. I'm literally looking at one of them on my workbench right now as we're recording in the studio. It's like I got a couple. And I got a few all around, actually. There's a zombie over there.
Oh, yeah. No, they're beautiful. I mean, and the thing was, especially when they came out, we had never seen toys like that.
No.
You know, it's the average superhero toy, and, you know, prior to like 95, 96, whatever it was, was a, you know, was like He-Man, you know, like Tootsie Roll arm muscles, you know, they weren't anatomically accurate at all. The paint jobs were crude at best. And then suddenly you had these characters that looked like the drawings. And that were painted beautifully, and it was a game changer.
Yeah, it's true, and all the you got that, and you also had the old Jurassic toys from that franchise, which I still got mine on a shelf in my workshop somewhere. And you hear that stuff today. This is a toy tangent, folks, but in the sense where I definitely want to put this out there, is that recently there's been a lot of fan hate towards the new. They're like, oh, the toys got evolved, like they did, and some say they didn't because, oh, they're not the rubber real feel stuff. So even though as the time goes on and stuff gets better for collectibles, some people feel that they don't. So despite contrary belief.
Yeah, it's like I say, I don't really track the stuff, so I don't know how. I can't really respond to that directly, but you know, I know that my knee jerk reaction is to say that everybody always thinks the thing that was popular or that they were into when they were young is much better than the crap that's coming out today, and that doesn't matter. I don't care if that's about music or comic books or movies or television shows. And you can watch it, because I've got friends who are 10, 15, 20 years older than me, and the stuff that I think is wonderful, they think is crap, because it came out after when they were kids. And I keep kind of pointing out to my sons, who just turned 31, that you know, they're going to they're starting to experience that now. You know, they thought I was kind of funny for saying this, you know, 5, 10 years ago, but they're starting to see, you know, animated shows just aren't as good as what they had, and that kind of stuff. And it's like, yeah, that's the nature of the beast.
It's true.
And we always prefer the stuff that was popular when we were into it.
I'm into that. I've been that weird sense. We're near the end of the show here, man, because I don't want to keep too much more of your time. But I've always been that sense where most of the things I love, I've realized as of late, most of the things I love are from the 70s to like the early 2000s.
It's like, yeah.
And I was like called an old fogey for loving that stuff when I was a kid, because I'm only 22. But right. Everyone's like, oh, he's the old man, like interest. And then as I got older, everyone's like, no, those are pretty good stuff. I'm like, yeah, you assholes.
Yeah. No, it makes a difference. I mean, it's there was a, it depends on which thing we're talking about, but there were cool toys. I mean, we had things like Shrunken Heads and Shrinky Dinks.
Oh, yeah.
All kinds of bizarre, cool things that, color forms and stuff like that, for kids. The Mego action figures or Mego action figures, which I was a huge fan of.
They're now back.
Yeah, they are. And it's and things like Micronauts, which I think we're going to see a renaissance of that stuff coming up.
Bet money. I will put money down on that.
Oh, yeah. It's, well, it was always cool. And cool doesn't really have a time limit. It comes back around.
It's true. History repeats itself, even in the nerd fandom. But, Kevin, I got to say, man, thank you for coming on the show here, because I don't want to, like I said, I don't want to take too much more of your time, but thank you, man, for coming on the show today.
Oh, you're very welcome. I enjoyed talking to you.
Of course.
And yeah, good luck with all your stuff.
You too as well. But before I let you go, do you have anything you want to promote that's coming out? I mean, obviously, Bloodshot movie coming out in next year, but...
I guess I should just point out that Bloodshot, the movie, comes out February 21st of 2020.
Yep.
The trailer's online now. If you haven't had a chance to check it out, check it out. Valiant Comics is publishing, Valiant Entertainment, I guess is what they technically are called, publishes new books with the character right now. One of my friends, Tim Seeley, has got a series going, which is really well done. And as I say, I'm starting to develop a couple of pilots and this comic book called The Fifth Horseman with Alex Arabia. So it's all stuff that I'm excited about and trying to keep all the balls in the air. That's pretty much it for me.
Love it. Where can people find you at on social media?
I'm on Facebook. It's just my name. Also Twitter. And I have Instagram, but I just rarely use it. I need to be better about that. But just kind of the usual suspects.
Fair enough. I love it. Folks, if you want to follow me and the show, you can follow me at Dakota_Morgan97 on Instagram or at DakotaMorgan3 on Twitter. And, yeah, thanks, everyone, for tuning in this episode. Kevin, any final words for the people at home?
No, just keep on keeping on. If you do the thing you love to do and try to go after it. If that's something you believe in and you want to create, then make it a point. You know, it's an old comment, but it's one I'll make anyway, I've heard people say things like, I could never write a novel. If I needed to write 365 pages, that's ridiculous. I'd never get it done. It's like, write one page a day. In a year, you're done.
Amen. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, but write that page a day. And that's the thing. And it's, there's nothing wrong was getting so far and deciding, okay, I've learned a lot. I'm not going to finish this one, but I am starting another one. Mm-hmm. You just don't want to make a habit of it to where you never finish anything. But that would be kind of the extent of the advice I have, besides what I said earlier about taking the shot and reaching out to people and getting feedback, and do it respectfully and do it kindly. And for the most part, you'll find that people are willing to spend time and give you their thoughts on your work.
Oh, I love it. Thank you, Kevin, again. And comic fans, stay classy.